Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of March 2017. Welcome to episode 22 of this podcast series. The concept of the show was to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time I did one of these episodes, which makes it pretty much, although not totally, the books I read during March. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost links to those on Facebook and Twitter so you can find them. But those posts are not spoilers for the podcast. Those are just lists. And here we do a little more review or critique, have a little more discussion. As we do on this show, I'm categorizing the books that I read, and first of the issues I read specifically for podcast appearances. We call those the homework books. I recorded an episode of Back to the Bins a few weeks back. I don't know when it's going to be released. Paul Spataro was banking a month's worth of assistant editor episodes, which are episodes with none of the regular hosts. I covered a book that I talked about here about 6 months ago, the first issue of Atlas Comics series The Destructor. But for that episode, I also read the book that Luke Giaconetti brought, World's Finest 240, an insane, nonsensical story by, that's right, you guessed, Bob Haney. And I read Gene Hendrick's book, A-Team Number 1. So subscribe to Back to the Bins, and at some point in the future, you'll hear that episode. And we recorded a pair of episodes recently with Tim Young from Deconstructing Comics and To the Batpoles. Oh, sorry, it's To the Batpoles! For that upcoming episode of Deconstructing, we talked about the first trade of the new Power Man and Iron Fist run, which I mentioned in last month's Comics Reading Journal. For what will probably end up as part of Short Box 51, we read the OGN Just So Happens by Fumio Obata, and picked this up from her library, thinking it would fit into the topic of taking a global view to the comics world. So those two episodes, our appearance on Deconstructing, and then Tim's appearance on Shortbox, are probably going to hit their respective feeds in early to mid-April. For Quarterbin 94, I read Madame Xanadu number 1, and for Quarterbin 95, I read Sandman 47 through 49. There is a super secret project that I have coming down the road. Well, here's the secret. It's Quarterbin episode 100. And for that epic, epic, epic episode, I read Nomad 2 and 3, that's the miniseries, X-Men 2099 3 and 4, Superman the Man of Steel 42 and 60, Adventures of Superman 551, Cloak and Dagger 1, that's the 83 miniseries, Morlocks number 3, and Mr. Miracle 1, 4, and 7. And comics I read for listening to podcasts. Adventures of Superman 524, Action 710, Superman Man of Steel 44 and 45, and Superman 100 and 101. These are among those 25-cent books that I've purchased over time to follow along with Mike Bailey and Jeffrey on From Crisis to Crisis. They have put out a nice number of consecutive weekly episodes recently, and it's been great dragging books out of the FCTC drawer to listen along. These issues are from the Death of Clark Kent storyline, where Clark's old buddy Kenny Braverman, a.k.a. Conduit, knows who Superman really is, and he's taking it out on everyone Superman loves. Those specific issues were covered on From Crisis to Crisis episodes 205 through 208. By the way, Adventures 524 was the very first book I covered on the Quarterbin podcast way back in July 2013. And there was one podcast-related book, podcast-adjacent book. From Half Price Books, I picked up and read Birds of Prey, Wolves. This is a one-shot from 1997, featuring Black Canary and Oracle, and written by the excellent Chuck Dixon. Stella covered this a month or so back on Batgirl Oracle 133, and I recognized the cover from the post for her episode. So I did pay a dollar for that one. But let me explain. It had 38 pages of story, so I did feel like I got my money's worth. And did I mention the Chuck Dixon part? And I actually think I liked this book a little more than Stella did. I like the parallelism of the two stories between Canary and Oracle, but both involve their dealings with men, and Stella didn't necessarily dig that male influence all that much. Taste is taste, I suppose, but I thought there was solid stuff in this issue. On to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. All of these are from DC, from the Rebirth era. Green Arrow, 17 through 19. The mayor is dead, and Ollie knows who did it. And that person then comes after Ollie himself. But just as Ollie is about to permanently take down this bad dude, Diggle stops him. Because Diggle evidently owes Malcolm Merlyn his life. Then with 18 and 19, you do a fictionalized version of the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. This storyline involves Roy Harper and his past relationship with Ollie, as well as the fact that the pipeline in question is owned and operated by Queen Industries. Now, M should really love this story because it's all about Ollie and his SJW tendencies. But then again, she hates Roy in his backward trucker cap, so you never know. Also, 18 was the first of the Mike Grell variant covers, which we have requested that Jeff at World's Greatest Comics make sure we get in our pull box. The cover for 18 was pretty good, but Grell's cover for 19 was terrific. Green Lanterns, 17 through 19, we wrap up the two-parter with Batman, which was really good. This team-up actually makes sense, especially when you throw in Fear Rings and the Scarecrow. There are similarities between Batman and the Green Lanterns, the role of fear, the role of willpower. Simon Baz has been carrying a sidearm throughout the series, and obviously Batman has a thing or two to say about that. And Bats points out how little he likes Green Lanterns historically. Hal was an egomaniac, and Guy's an idiot. But Simon, he thinks he can work with. So there is the promise of more team-ups in the future, I suppose. But after that two-issue diversion, we get back to Volthoom, the first Lantern. And that issue, issue 18, is really just one long narrative piece that gives us some history of the Guardians, of the Power Rings, etc., and a bit about Rami, the Guardian, who's been hanging around with Simon and Jessica. And speaking of Simon and Jessica, I was hoping, after reading 17 and 18, that we would get back to them soon. I liked the Batman issues, but our lead characters were sort of in the background of those, and they actually didn't appear at all in the Volthoom issue. But that is just what happened, fortunately, because issue 19 featured the duo going up against this modern take on Dr. Polaris. DC Bombshells 23. Wonder Woman has returned to the front, where she finds a glowing green rock and gets picked up by Alexander Luthor in his invisible plane. Returning to Zambezi, she aids the Bombshells in their aiding of Queen Mari in her battle against ancient mechanical animals that turn out to be Thanagarian in origin. Wonder Woman, 17 and 18. The Truth storyline continues with action in a lot of different places. Mostly it's Team WW in action, both in Themyscira and in Our World. Diana is still pretty messed up, laid up in hospital in London. And there was some discussion of the various identities that Diana has held over the years. In God Watch, Dr. Cyber makes sure that Wonder Woman fails her old friend Dr. Minerva. And along with the evil help of Phobos and Deimos, Barbara Ann turns back into the Cheetah. And there was one other comic I read that's sort of related to the new comics that I just mentioned. And that's because, timed to coincide with the premiere of the second season on AMC, polybagged with Green Arrow 18, I received a free copy of a promo book from about 18 months ago, Into the Badlands Special Number 1. I didn't watch a second of the first season of that show, but this prequel comic set the scene well and did a good job, I think, of telling the intro story. This reprint also included 4 pages of intros for characters on the show, setting the table for where the second season goes, I guess, or at least where it starts. Overall, it was a pretty interesting special issue. And on to the general comic reading that I did. My good friend, the great Kansan, Greg Arujo, sent some books a few months back to me, and among those was Ray Bradbury Comics number 1. This was a 5-issue series from Topps Comics from 1993. The theme of this issue was dinosaurs, and featured new adaptation of his classic story, A Sound of Thunder, and of Tyrannosaurus Rex. There's also contained in this book an older EC era adaptation of A Sound of Thunder. That one was by Al Williamson, a real master of sci-fi comic stories. It was pretty cool seeing 2 different takes on the same source material. A Sound of Thunder is a pretty short story, so there were many more similarities than differences between the 2 adaptations of the same story. But you do get to see differences in style over the years. The earlier one, from the EC era, has a lot of text boxes, which I imagine are direct quotes from the story. So you're really just illustrating the story as much as adapting it. The newer one has a lot more speech bubbles. Much more of the narrative is given to us in that format. But either way, it's a classic sci-fi story about the effects that stepping on a butterfly a few million years ago can have on us today. I visited my dad in Eastern North Carolina over my recent spring break. And whenever I do, I make sure to visit Carolina Comics and More, which usually has a couple of cheap books available. Between the 50 cent and the quarter box, I picked up about 10 books for about $3.50. The quarter books went straight into the database for the podcast, and the other ones I just read, including the OMAC Project Infinite Crisis Special. This is a one-shot that takes place just before the 2006 Checkmate series. It's actually pretty much issue 0 of that title. It does tell a complete story, which is why I bought it. When you're going through the cheap bins, you always look for the words "the end" on the last page as opposed to be continued. This one was written by Greg Rucka, which is also another reason why I bought it. In the story, Sasha Bordeaux disobeys Amanda Waller on when to directly take on Brother I. Fire is sent out to stop Sasha, and much drama ensues at the conclusion of the story. I enjoyed this one. In general, Checkmate is a blind spot in my comic book reading history. I covered one issue 17, back in Quarter Bin episode 42, but other than that, I haven't read much, really, of any iteration of Checkmate. And Betty and Veronica, number 1. This is the 1987 series. The original title, Archie's Girls, Betty and Veronica, ran 347 issues from 1950 to 1987. After a month break, this title began, and it ran another 278 issues until December 2015, and then about 6 months ago, it was again rebooted in the new Archie era. I'm going to talk more about Betty and Veronica later in the episode, I think, but in terms of this one, it was very solid. There were a couple of great bits with the girls' fathers, especially when they try to dress appropriately for 1987 to relate to their daughters. Hiram Lodge with a mohawk. That's all I'm saying. And Walt Disney's Donald Duck Adventures number 2. I love it when good kids' books are in the cheap bins. Of course, in retrospect, I feel bad that I'm buying them and not leaving them there for kids. Anyway, I'm pretty sure I got that one in North Carolina. If not, it may have been World's Greatest Comics here in Ohio. My record keeping is occasionally insufficient. Anyway, this is a 1987 reprint from Gladstone of a 1951 Carl Barks story. This is a full issue 24-pager, Dangerous Disguise. It's a Cold War spy thriller, and it's really, really good. It starts with Donald and the boys being sent to the Riviera by Scrooge just to get them out of his hair for a while. But by page 2, the spy stuff has started. And by page 5, Donald is fully involved. We have a dramatic train chase, followed by Donald ending up as a bullfighter. There are lots and lots of crosses and double crosses and double-double crosses. It is really a solid, smart satire on the spy films of the era. When Barks got a full-length issue to tell a story, it was almost always really good. And they often had this sense of sweep to them, large stories being told on a large canvas. The combination of funny stuff along with pretty gripping action-adventure stuff, hard to beat. Really enjoyable comic book. From great listener Clinton Robison of the Coffee and Comics blog and podcast, I recently received a few books, including Free Comic Book Day 2014, Sherwood, Texas. This is basically a reimagination of the tales of Robin Hood as a modern-day Western in the town of Sherwood, Texas. We have the beginnings of a tale of revenge set inside the world of biker gangs. This would lead right into issue 1. It was put out by 12 Gauge Comics and won a total of 5 issues. I did look on Hoopla for it, but it wasn't there. But I am kind of intrigued by the story, I have to admit. He also sent Free Comic Book Day 2015, Wonderland. This is from Xenoscope, and it's a pretty good package overall. It says when the story takes place after issue 30, and then tells what is both an introductory background story, but also sets up what I assume would have been the next storyline. The house ad notes that the company is reprinting number 1 of this series this same month as the 2015 Free Comic Book Day with a $1 price tag. And the inside back cover also has the official reading order for the series and the varying spin-offs and supplemental books that they have. It's actually one of the more new reader-friendly approaches to a book, to a Free Comic Book Day book in particular, that I've seen. It definitely does what those Free Comic Book Day promo books are supposed to do. All right, it's time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, long runs, graphic novels, stuff like that.
Hello there, this is Jared Albrick, a.k.a. The Yard Sale Artist, with a quick podcast promo for my show, Comics with Normies. Here's how the show works. Using my yard sailing skills, I acquire a random comic book from a yard sale. I then give said random comic to a normie, a normie being a person who doesn't normally read comic books. Then, on the show, I'll sit down with the normie to discuss the issue, get a real outsider's point of view, and see what some of the comics that we love, and maybe not love so much, seem like to those normal folks we see walking around on the streets each day. It should be a fun perspective and good for a few laughs. You can check out the Comics with Normies podcast, along with some other fun-filled podcasts from White Rocket Entertainment, on iTunes and at whiterocket.podbean.com. And feel free to join the show using Twitter handle at Normies Podcast or on Facebook at Comics with Normies. Once again, you can find Comics with Normies on iTunes and at whiterocket.podbean.com. We'll see you there.
And we're back. Next up, the trades and graphic novels and miniseries and long runs that I read. Detective Comics, 934 through 940. As more and more of the Rebirth trades show up on Hoopla, I'm reading more and more of them. This is the Bat Family book that I've heard the best thing about and was definitely looking forward to reading it. This is Batman bringing together a team of Red Robin, Spoiler Orphan, and Clayface under the leadership of himself and Batwoman Kathy Kane. I don't know how long the Waynes and the Kanes have been related, but in this version, Martha Wayne was a Kane. That added another layer of personal drama. And of course, there's always a ton of drama when Batman is dealing with members of the Bat family. I've become a big fan of the writing of James Tynion IV over the last few years, and he does an excellent job making this team make sense and making the relationships among the teammates make sense. This is one of the Rebirth books I had heard really good things about, and even with high expectations, I thought that this was very, very good. As many of you may know, I'm a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes. And one of the great things about Holmes fans that I've run across is that they, and we, are very willing to consider with open minds different takes on our favorite characters. One of the geniuses of what Doyle created was that the character can work in so many different scenarios. You can take Holmes out of his era, out of his locale, and still tell good stories and somehow not alienate all the Holmesian fans. With all of that as prelude, let me talk about reading The Baker Street Peculiars 1 through 4. This is a Kaboom series from last year, written by Roger Langridge and Andy Hirsch. It focuses on three young characters that take on the irregulars. These detectives in training have all caught the attention of Holmes, and he uses them as foot soldiers in a case involving disappearing statues that, in fact, turn out to be golems. But the bigger mystery is who exactly has hired the peculiars? Is that really Holmes? And if not, then who is it? This is a kid book with exaggerated kid art, so I understand that it may not work for everyone, but the mystery, the kids' characterizations, and that ultimate mystery of what exactly is going on at 221B Baker Street made this, for me, a really fun read. I love the world of Sherlock Holmes, and any chance to spend time there, whatever the particulars, is often time well spent. Afterlife, with Archie 7 through 10, it's been a long time since I read an issue of this. I covered the first six with my friends Bill Robinson and the late Sean Engel as a crossover on Relatively Geeky Presents and Walking Dead Wednesday. Those were for Halloween 2014. But of course, one of the nice things about being a reader of Afterlife with Archie is you can skip reading the title for more than 2 years and find that you've only missed four issues. In this second arc, Betty R.I.P., we have the surviving members of the gang wandering the hinterlands after the fall of Riverdale. It's less plot advancement and more atmosphere and character work. For example, Archie spends an entire issue chatting with Jughead, who died in the first issue. And it's not a flashback either. It may be his imagination, or a dream, or maybe he is chatting with Jughead's ghost. We also get an issue focusing on Reggie, whose actions laid the groundwork for the zombie apocalypse, and the guilt that's eating him up. And we spend an issue with Josie and the Pussycats, and learn what connection their backstory has to the afterlife verse. The plot advancement that we do get involves the past histories between the Riverdale civic leaders and the Witches of Greendale. Not exactly a crossover with Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, but they do have some things in common. And it's fascinating to watch the Riverdale TV show and see that they have pulled very specific relationship, character traits, plot points from Afterlife. In issue 7, for example, Jason Blossom is killed. And maybe not by a zombie, if you know what I mean. I'm not saying they're going full zombie on the TV show, but it does mean that they're mining the series, this version of the characters, for as much stuff as they possibly can. and from my buddy Iowa's Joe Crawford, who sent me a box of books a few months ago. I read Tomboy 1 through 8. This is an ongoing from 2015 from Action Lab. Iowa's Joe actually sent me the first six. The other two I read on Hoopla. The first issue carries this advisory label, which sums up the comic very, very well. This book contains violence, blood, murder, madness, and magical girls. Addie is a typical 16-year-old girl living a typical 16-year-old girl life. A good friend of hers is killed, and a chance encounter brings her into contact with the killers, a pair of corrupt cops on the payroll of an evil pharmaceutical company. And that is when she discovers her secret powers, which are to bring vicious and gory death to anyone who deserves it. This is a talent that runs a bit in her family, and her grandfather mentors her in delivering judgment on all who have been working for the evil pharmaceutical company. And he also picks up a few ghostly companions along the way, and they sort of, kind of in a manner of speaking, help her along and encourage her in her mission. The vigilante catches the attention of the police, and they make the terrible mistake of considering Addie's best friend a suspect for the death that she has, in fact, been delivering. And that plot point brings some ugliness to the story all the way around. It's a pretty interesting story, and though I've never watched or read much in the magical girl genre, it was an interesting read. The mashup with the over-the-top violence and the big business conspiracy caught me by surprise. And although the basic premise has its origins in manga, the art is more traditionally Western than that, and that helped me enjoy the read, I think. I'll keep my eyes out on Hoopla for the next trade, because this is one where I do want to know where the story's going. 24 Underground, 1 through 5. This is a series that came out in 2014, just before Live Another Day, the 12-episode return of the show, which was 4 years after Season 8. This fills in some of the blanks about what Jack Bauer was doing in those 4 years between TV seasons. Still considered a fugitive from both the U.S. and the Russian governments, Bauer has settled himself into a quiet life under an assumed identity in Odessa, Ukraine. He works on the docks, having landed an unassuming job as an unassuming longshoreman, and he has a new love. But his boss, who is also his girlfriend's brother, has been saddled with their dead brother's debts to the Russian mafia. This brings Jack face-to-face with an adversary from his former life, and also threatens to expose his whereabouts to CIA agents tasked with bringing him to justice. So Jack has to face the Ukrainian mafia, the CIA, and an angry ex-friend. It's a pretty good story, but this didn't have to be a 24 story. It could have been any former spy or any man-in-hiding where the past reaches out type of story. It does take place in one day. There's that 24 aspect, but it doesn't have the hour-by-hour conceit or strictures of the show. But it was really good, although I probably did miss out a little bit by not actually reading it when I should have, between the seasons of the TV show. And it's also really weird nowadays seeing Jack Bauer on TV as the U.S. president while some other dudes are running around at CTU. Very confusing. Another of my Hoopla finds was Betty and Veronica, Jumbo Comics 247. See, I promised I'd talk about them again. As I've said before, Hoopla has tons and tons of Archie comics available. There's a limitation to the number of books you can borrow from Hoopla every month. That specific number varies from library to library, and it resets on the first of the month. Well, as February was winding down, I had one borrowing availability left, and I decided to look for a long Archie digest, something I could read on a plane. And this one is 250 pages, so it accomplished its mission of taking some time for me to get through it. This seemed to be mostly pretty modern stories from maybe the year 2000 onward, including the lead story that was very recent because it was about the trend of adult coloring books. Mr. Lodge starts coloring as a way to relax himself, but as soon as Archie gets involved in the new hobby, it becomes anything but relaxing for Mr. Lodge. Most of the other stories were standard B&V stories, but I find that these stories are actually quite varied. I've mentioned in the past that some of the other Archie characters seem to have limited story potentials, and you end up reading pretty similar stories over and over again. But these are just two good high school friends. So there's a pretty unlimited canvas for stories, actually. And so with this one, even at 250 pages, they hit, you know, a few personality traits over and over, but they didn't really retell the same story over and over. Most of these stories were very solid. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, Afterlife with Archie is pretty great, and the Jughead issue, issue 8, stands out. Power Man and Iron Fist, number 5. We talk about that on Deconstructing Comics. That was really good. And I enjoyed the Baker Street Peculiars. But if you've listened to Quarter Bin 95, you know that I raved about the Sandman books. They're just terrific. And of those three, I'm saying that Sandman number 48 was the best comic I read in March. And I know I say that much to Dr. Ange's dismay. Now, next month has 5 Sundays. And I have an academic conference in Jacksonville, Florida. And that usually means extra time to read comics. Not at the paper presentations, but at meals and airports and on planes. So there's a good chance that next month's episode will be pretty good sized. And that April episode should come out sometime in early May. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. That blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. You can follow the network on Twitter at relatively_geek, and of course the network has its own page on Facebook as well. Come join us. Thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.